Here we are, June 8th, lecture discussion number 46 on Genesis 1 through 19. As I'm writing this late last night, I kind of got carried away. Yeah, I really didn't intend to go very far, 4 or 5 pages in one direction. I ended up going 14. A super rabbit trail. That's right. Rabbit trail on steroids today. And rabbit's going to hit 75 home runs today. I'm kind of a baseball guy, as you know. And I very much enjoyed watching the Major League Baseball players come back to reality after they've stopped the steroid abuse. So that's another thing entirely, but it makes me laugh. Okay, we took a shot at Joshua 9 and 2 Samuel 21 the last two Sundays, and I know how important it is to get Satan in. You can't pass him by, as I've said. He is so important in the census. And so the census is tied to the Gibeonites. The Gibeonites are tied to Joshua 9. Joshua 9 is tied to Genesis 34. So I need to bring Satan out, and I started placing him in the mix, and that's how I got to 14, 15 pages today. And so I know I can't do that many, and we'll just try as best we can to get through it as quickly as possible, get to the rice and the meatballs. Sometimes we have meatballs and no rice, and the complaints is for, but today we've got rice. As I said, we took a shot at Joshua 9 and 2 Samuel 21. Didn't finish them the last two Sundays. Still have to go back. We'll go back hopefully today a little bit. And we did that as we accumulate all this information and evidence with regard to the events of the Gardens of Gethsemane and Golgotha, the Sorrow Garden and the Dying Garden. I keep repeating that because that's a very important piece to keep in the forefront. More specifically, the motives or the plan of Satan contrasted with the redemptive work of Christ. That's why this is a Genesis lecture, because that's Genesis 3:15, the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. And when and where and how does that take place through Scripture and, of course, in time? And what Christ purposed to do in both gardens? In Gethsemane, the great sorrow, the dramatic theodicy that is there, it is a portrayal of the collision of God's love and God's justice, which of course is the Abrahamic covenant, Genesis 15. The elements that are just off the top of my head, I wrote these down so that you would know, but there are many more than this. The sleeping disciples, Judas is in Gethsemane, the Romans come, the Pharisees come, the temple police come. I have the mystery of the two swords. I've got Malchus's ear cut off. I have that great question, whom do you seek? And the I ams. Of course, he puts Malchus's head back on, doesn't he? And that's just, as I said, a few. Golgotha, elements there, the two thieves, the seven sayings, the location of Goliath's head, which is why it's called Golgotha. The gambling, the lots for the garment of Christ. The centurion who makes his great announcement. The two wines. The darkness, Simeon the centurion. The rent veil, Joseph and Nicodemus, and the tomb that they cut out there and prepare. Again, that's just a few of both. Each garden has specific elements, events, and Jesus intended and included them. And it's a fulfillment of prophecy, and it's also a lesson. That's why it's called a dramatic theodicy. It is a portrayal, a teaching for us, for the Jews. But it is a fulfillment of prophecy, and as a fulfillment of prophecy, we must expect which prophecy would be the most fulfilled. Well, I'm going to propose that it's the first promise. It's the Proto-Evangelium, Genesis 3:15. That is the prominent prophecy that takes place in the two gardens. And it is fulfilled there in some fashion or most fashion. And thus, this most asked question keeps coming up. And it and I refer to it, it falls under the classification of not resolvable, or what they'll call speculative analysis. But this is the question. I have two gardens, Gethsemane and Golgotha. Are the gardens of Gethsemane and the garden of Golgotha, is that the site of what? The two trees. That's correct. Not the Garden of Eden, but the two trees are in the Garden of Eden, but is it specifically the sites of the two trees? The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, or what I call the tree of surely death? Because he said, you eat from this tree, surely you will die. So I have the surely death tree, and I have the tree of life. So I have the tree of death and the tree of life. Is the Garden of Golgotha and the Garden of Gethsemane the two places where Christ puts all of this material for us, a lifetime of material? Just pick one garden, much less both gardens. I get asked all the time, is this the place of these two trees? The specific location. Would Christ know where those trees were? Of course he would. Would he know where the skulls buried? Of course he would. So now, that if you follow with that, if you accept the hypothesis, and keep in mind, it's common to be asked that, but it's probably not the preeminent position with regard to where the two trees are. You will hear, as you've heard me say, Babylon and Jerusalem. But anyway, if one accepts the hypothesis, the premise, then let's go a little further. Upon which garden was which tree? In other words, under which tree is Goliath's skull buried by David? Did David know he was burying Goliath's skull under a tree? Probably not. He just buried one where he was told to bury it. But if that is the site of one of these two trees, then the obvious question, under which of these trees is Goliath's skull buried? Is it the tree of death, which would put it in Golgotha, or is it the tree of life, which would put it in Gethsemane? Or is it the other way around? Is it the tree of life in Golgotha and the tree of death in Gethsemane? Vote now. Press your button. We will announce the tally at the end of the summer. It's summer. When we get the other voters. obviously there's a great deal of thought here. He dies in Golgotha. So is that the tree of death? But he is the tree of life. So would he put himself where the tree of life was? Which would be more logical to you, and why would he put the skull underneath the tree of life? Well, that's because of Genesis 3:15. It's a picture of that, isn't it? His feet would be on top of the skull of Goliath, which is an Antichrist figure. Okay. Before rushing off to Joshua 10 and Genesis 34 and 35, and both are necessary, as I said, you got to add Joshua 9, 2 Samuel 21, 1 Chronicles 21, 2 Samuel 24, and then you got Joshua 10 and Genesis 34 and 35. And we're going to do that so that we could understand why Satan himself is involved in David's census. David's very foolish, very wicked census of the military age men without the Exodus 30, 11 through 16 atonement money. Satan is involved in that. So we need to know why he's involved in that. And we need to know why Saul killed the Gibeonites. And we need to know why Judas hanged himself and why the Antichrist gathers an army to oppose Christ at Armageddon. All of that is what we're discussing, though it may not seem it. And before we go through that, see, you should be asking yourself now, why did Judas hang himself, and what does that have to do with the two gardens and the killing of the Gibeonites and the census? Why did Judas hang himself? Is he stupid? Is he remorseful? Okay, so now why is he doing it? It's part of one of Satan's plans. How does that fit? He is a destroyer. He is. But does he need to destroy Judas? Judas is very close to him. Huh? Right. It wasn't the time, but what does it have to do? Is it an insignificant event? And I don't think it is. I think you'll find that it has very much a connection to his plan with the Gibeonites as well, and his plan with the census as well. And notice how I threw in the Gibeonites. Okay. Let's ask some interesting questions. At least they're interesting to me, and I possess the most holy dry erase marker, so I get to choose the questions most of the time. Okay, some of the time, a few of the times, but let's go ahead and ask these questions that I think are interesting to me. First question is why does Satan continue? By continue, I didn't say answer, I said I'm asking. Why is it that Satan continues? By continue, I mean, let me define that. Why persevere in what he must know is a hopeless campaign? Untenable, my favorite word, isn't it, Amanda? It is an untenable campaign. Revelation 12:12 is an illustration of Satan's thought process. Little snippet. Let's go read that. You've read it many times, I'm sure. Therefore, rejoice, O heavens, that you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants. Why are the heavens rejoicing? Because they have had a physical war in which Satan is cast out of heaven and has no longer got access to it and is restricted now to the first heaven, which is the atmospheric heaven of this earth. Therefore, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath because he knows that he has a short time. That's extraordinary. Satan can tell time. Don't take that for granted. Who else can tell time? Who else knows how much time is left? Satan knows how much time he has. And when he gets to that point, why not simply surrender? It is impossible to win. It is impossible to succeed. Really? What does Satan consider to be winning? What does he consider to be victory? It is noteworthy that very few of humanity, very few being a relative term, the gate is narrow, very few also surrender to God. If you surrender to God, what's he call that? Salvation. Very few surrender to God. Most do what? They most fight. Why? It's hopeless. It's absolutely hopeless. But it's very interesting to me that note that Satan is fighting what is clearly a hopeless endeavor, and he knows it. So what is his definition of victory? And mankind, most of humanity, does exactly the same thing. Do you think that's a coincidence? Most of humanity rushes to condemnation willfully, having contempt for the one who gives them life. Won't take it. John's verse. You will live long on earth. What's that mean? Well, what's the obvious question? When will you live long on earth? You're not living long now. I certainly am not. It's pretty obvious. I need a bigger hat. I have blue and black socks. It's your fault. Point is, don't groan. Point is that we will be given life and we will have a long life. How long will the life be? Eternal. Yeah. So we should note the pattern. It's not coincidental that Satan is fighting in an impossible situation, and all of humanity, or most of humanity, is likewise. Anyway, let's consider Satan's situation, realizing that it's Judas's situation and the Antichrist's shared situation as well. Satan is opposing, he is conducting warfare against God. What's the logic behind it? And note that it is a war. We're also a part of this war, and the angels are part of this war, Ephesians 6:12 and Revelation 12:7. But ultimately, this is Genesis 3:15. This is the bruising of the heel and the crushing of the head. Satan starts out knowing what? He's a loser. Yeah, starts out. That's his first prophecy. He knows it's a loss for him. So why fight? I hate to use Big Ty again, but he made a profound statement about his baseball team. When his baseball team gets behind, what do? They quit. Look, I've been coaching a long time. Teams get behind, what do? They quit. If I took this congregation, significantly physically adept, and we went out and played the Green Bay Packers. Okay, how long would we fight? Would we even run out onto the field in our clean uniforms? Most of us would be ashamed and embarrassed, and we'd stay in the locker room. We'd go to the after. He's retired. Okay. But we'd go to the after game buffet and skip the game, right? The point being is who will struggle when it is hopeless? Who does that? And Satan really knows that he's going to lose. Our definition of win, see? We look at it like a boxing match. He isn't looking at it that way. We look at it like a basketball game. He's not doing that. He knows if it's a basketball game, the score is infinity to zero. That's not how he's approaching it. And you have to know how he's approaching it, so then you'll see why he moved at the census, why he saw that as an opportunity. Satan may not have immediately recognized that the seed of the woman would be the hypostatic union. He may not have. God adding humanity to himself. But I believe that Satan has now figured that out, probably after the wilderness testing, perhaps after the crucifixion, the Garden of Golgotha. That's another one of those speculative analysis things. I like to call them reasoned interpretive conclusions based on available evidence, but I know that I cannot resolve it, that it is just, in fact, speculative analysis. And I'm aware people will mock and scoff me. Mockers and scoffers abound. Or they will correct me, whichever one you prefer. I prefer mocking and scoffing, but I'm very well aware that correcting could very, very much be part of the equation. But nonetheless, out of politeness, humor me along. Satan is warring against the omniscient God. God knows all things, sees all things, and is outside of time, and that's quite the strategic advantage. God knows Satan's thoughts before Satan knows his own thoughts. God holds matter in place, so if he decided to go poof, Satan goes poof. That's, again, quite a strategic advantage. So Satan is not fighting this the way you would think, perhaps. He has a different plan in place. God is omnipresent. Satan cannot find a place that God isn't at. And so there are no secrets from God. Duh alert. Ding, ding, ding. Stop the sermon. There are no secrets from God. If ever you think you are having one, you are what? Brain damaged. You don't have any secrets from God. You're not hiding from Him. It is impossible to hide from Him. Sorry. Not really sorry. Fake sorry. Yeah, you're just not going to avoid it. There aren't any secrets. God has the ultimate CIA, if you will. We're worried about our government spying on us. It's impossible for God to do anything but spy on you, if you want to use the word spy. It's in omnipresence and omniscience. Planning against him to defeat him is what? It's ridiculous. But yet Satan does it. Satan has planning methods. He has, I'm sure he does, he has planning classes. Come to How to Defeat God, Class 101. But I'm proposing to you that he knows what he's doing. Satan is attempting to defeat omniscience and omnipotence and omnipresence, knowing full well that his existence depends on God's constant thought. So how do you proceed against that? Satan would devise and has devised a counter strategy. He would consider the military options. What's the obvious question there? Why is he doing it? Very important to understand why he's doing it. And keep in mind Ezekiel 28. What does it say in Ezekiel 28 about Satan? Yes, he is filled to the brim. The Hebrew means this, that I have a glass and it fills to the point where it almost overflows. He is filled to overflowing with wisdom. And what else? He's got two characteristics in beauty. That's right. He has wisdom and beauty. That's Satan. So if you ever have a position that says that Satan is ugly and stupid, you're in big trouble. Don't do that. Filled with wisdom and beautiful. The highest of the cherubim, the anointed cherub, the one with the greatest beauty. He was also what? The closest to God. In authority, in contact, he has authority all over the angelic host. I happen to notice a connection. I know Judas is part of the disciples. I have then therefore done what? I have compared him to Satan and God because I think I have a repeat of the same thing. And so I will tell you that Judas is the closest of all the disciples to Christ. He is the one with the highest authority of the disciples, and he's the what? Most beautiful. So if you have a position that says Judas is stupid and ugly and weak, then I'm going to tell you, you're coming up against the types that are all through Scripture. And thus this plan of Satan begins to form. A full face-to-face, obvious, physical, frontal attack against God is senseless. It is insane, and Satan is not that. So he wouldn't do that. Therefore, it's necessary to do what he can do. He has one terrific thing he can do. He can lie. Can he lie to God? No. Stupid. And he's not. So he must have someone to lie to. He can lie. He can deceive those whom God creates. I propose that Satan knows who is on the other side of the chessboard fully, more than we could ever imagine. He knows that he is confronting, rebelling against God. He knows that the other general on the warfield, on the battlefield, is God. And so that is ridiculous to attack and seek to destroy God. So he is seeking to destroy the pieces on the chessboard. It's the soldiers that are the treasures. It is the pieces that can be overcome. Satan either concluded, he knew beforehand, or certainly immediately after, that God would not destroy him when he rebelled. God would not annihilate him when he made his first lie. I always want to know, what was the first lie? But Satan, I believe, knew that God would not annihilate him on that first lie. As soon as he thought that he would lie, what did he know? The instant he had the thought, what did he know? Satan. He knew that God knew the thought. Not only did God know the thought, but God knew everything leading to the thought. And here is Satan with a thought of sin, with a rebellious heart, and he still exists. What would he do? He would ask why. Why doesn't God smote me? We would do that to our kids. As soon as you've got a rebellious heart, smote. Satan knew that God knew his first sinful, rebellious thought, and yet God did not seem to immediately respond. And by the way, where else does that show up in Scripture? All over the place. Absolutely right. Let's take Adam and Eve. Eve is walking through the tree of death. Why doesn't God stop her? Does God know she's going to do it? Why doesn't he stop her? She's got the apple in her, the fruit, whatever you wish it to be, the fig in her hand. Why doesn't he stop her? See, same question. Why didn't he stop Satan? And then let's have another question. Why didn't he stop us? See, same for us. God would wait, and he would put what in this? He would put time in it. Satan would attack the truth. Satan would attack he who is absolute truth with lies, and God would wait. And by the way, the lies are always the same. They're always the same. They never change. They're absolutely identical. That's why it's fun to figure out what the lies are. And then you see them all the time show up. And the people who bring them to me don't even know that they are using a lie that is so ancient and it's identical. Satan does have the P.T. Barnum approach to this. There's always going to be somebody that thinks they're the first one to hear this lie. And they can't wait to rush out and tell you about it. But there's only one truth, and truth is absolute, by the way. Truth is singular. It's alone. There aren't many truths. I know that you're going to come up afterwards and say, well, there are many truths. No, we'll get to this in a second. There's one truth. And it all becomes math. There's one truth, and therefore there is one God, and there is one path, and there is one salvation, and there is one Savior. God is one, Deuteronomy 6:4. Then all the lies come. See, once you know that, then you see the lies. Somebody says there's no God? Lie. Somebody says there's many gods? Lie. Many paths? We can all go up our own mountain and get to God. One of our presidential candidates asked him flat out. How many ways can you get to God? Oh, there's all kinds of ways. The Hindu way, the Islam way, there are all kinds of ways. No, there's one way. It's very hard to call yourself a Christian and be a universalist, but I know it's common. Someone says there's many paths, that's a lie. There are many saviors, it's a lie. There's no judgment, that's a lie. Thousands of religions say that man can save himself, all of them lie. There is one that says salvation is a gift, that it is grace, and that is the one truth. So Satan would know. This leads me to this. You could hopefully see how I got here. Satan would know that killing the Gibeonites would cause a famine. Satan would know taking a sentence without the atonement silver would cause a plague. Satan would know rejecting Christ as the nation of Israel did in Matthew 12. Would be unpardonable and they would face a slaughter. He would know because that's where he's placed his lies. See, Satan understands God's purpose for the nation of Israel. What are they at the time he's attacking them? What are they today? He was chosen, wasn't he? God of all the cherubim, what did he do with Satan? He picked him out and made him what? The most wise, the closest, right? The anointed, and the ruler over the others. What did he do with the nation of Israel? He plucked them out, didn't he? He made them the chosen. He made them the anointed. He made them the firstborn. He made them the closest. They were the possessors of the one truth. And they were the ruling nation. The nation of priesthood. Satan understands that very, very well. It's the same pattern, isn't it? And Satan would lie. He would deceive to accomplish what exactly? Note that the one closest, the one filled with wisdom, filled with beauty, with all the weapons at his disposal, would choose his method, deception. And so there's a bunch of obvious implications of that. Besides the insanity of a face-to-face confrontation, Satan, the father of lies, the first liar, he is the first one to lie. Again, which lie was that? What did he say first when he lied? in order to achieve his five I wills of Isaiah 14, 12 through 15, he would not use force and power, though he has it. And though he was filled with violence within, Ezekiel 28, 16, he does not use violence. Instead, he began with deception, and now lets many questions come up. Did Satan know that to those whom he lied, did he know that they possessed the capacity to believe the lie? See, why would he lie? If you would, I have a beautiful puppy still lab, and Henri German Shepherd that came with a girl. Most people would say the girl came with the dog, but we can look at it the other way. I'm kidding. Don't tell her. I'll get a bad haircut next time. Does it make any sense to lie to that lab or that German Shepherd? I do it, but it makes no sense. Why not? They don't have the capacity to believe my lies. I lie to them all the time. Come in here and be, there will be biscuits for you. And then they go in, I shut the door behind them, I sneak out of the house. They don't know that I lied to them. Or trick them or deceive them. I'm being silly. They don't have the capacity. Did Satan know when he made his first lie that the person, and what was the person? Human or angelic? Angelic. Did he know that that angelic being had the capacity to believe the lie? If he did know it, how did he figure that out? First person you lied to was who? Yourself. He didn't believe his own lie. But he thought he could fool somebody else. How'd he get there? Again, did Satan know that to those whom he lied, that they possessed the capacity to believe the lie and then the ability to act on the lie? What that means, of course, is as they act on the lie, what do they become? Rebellious, in sin, right? That God would not, He would not interfere, if you will. He would allow the act on the lie to come forth. So Satan had a pretty good understanding of what? What's the doctrine? Where are we at now? See, you think about that yourself. How did this occur? The steps, the anatomy of all of it. When and how did Satan determine that the angelic host could be deceived? Recognize he had a whole group of undeceived beings, and he said to himself, somewhere, somehow, I can lie and deceive them. How well did he do? The angelic host. Pretty darn strong. How's he done with humanity? Oh, he's amazing. He's got us all. There are none that have not been deceived. See, I have the fivefold lies of Satan, and I might put them on the board if I got time, but let me go over them really fast. And there's really small print. I wrote it bigger. Page 17. Remind me where I was. I've already forgotten. Fivefold lies of Satan. God is afraid of sin. You'll see that all the time. God allows sin because he's afraid of sin. What does that say? God's not omnipotent. He doesn't have all the power. Then the one that is number two, God is not omniscient and he is not omnipresent. He is therefore not outside of time, and the name that he has for himself is a what? Right. So then we get to God lies. What's the name that he has for himself? I am, which is that he is outside of and the creator of time. You will hear always, always, time is before the most, I just don't know how to respond to it anymore. I hear it from little children. I hear it from adults. What's before God? Hear it all the time. What's the implication of that question? That's correct. And the premise is a lie. It's one of the fivefold lies of Satan. It's one of the oldest lies in all of humanity, but you still hear it today like it's brand new. It's not brand new. He is not subject to time. Number three, God can be killed. You see it also as Christ can be killed. If God can be killed or Christ can be killed, then he is a created being and therefore what? Not the Creator. Very, very ancient lie. Christ is not God. Christ is not human. They're the same thing. In other words, there's no hypostatic union. Genesis 3:15. What that is saying is that God is not triune. Okay? And therefore, salvation is not by grace. Does that make sense? Think about that for a second. Christ is not God. Christ is not human. God is not triune, and therefore salvation is not by grace. Can you figure that out? We'll get to it in a second. God is, number five, God is not just. He is not fair. He is not absolute pure truth, and he is not absolute pure good. In which, in that, and you can see that from there we go that God lies, that God has sin, that God will not judge. Where do I get God will not judge? Out of God is not fair, just, or truth. Yeah, well, he will not judge because if he's not fair, he won't judge. And if he doesn't judge, then he will not come. He will not return. So you have all those issues as well. Okay? Now, back to where I was. Where was I? Here I am. When did and how did Satan determine the angelic host could be deceived and would then rebel and could rebel and that God would wait and would take time to respond? When did Satan figure that out? Because that is ultimately his tack. Satan's plan essentially is his knowledge of the capacity of his target to willingly believe and act upon lies about the nature and character of God. And Satan would know, rely upon, God's goodness and his mercy, which is time. Time is waiting. Waiting is patience. Patience is long-suffering. He would rely upon God hiding, if you will, not immediately revealing his omnipresence. And by the way, there's your prayer for today, your prayer lesson. What is prayer? In its essence, prayer is a recognition of the omnipresence of God and the omniscience of God in its essence. He has to hear you. He has to know. You are admitting to him by praying that you know that he is omnipresent and omniscient. Now, apply that to the killing of the Gibeonites in the census of David. You don't probably think I can, do you? Saul is slaughtering the Gibeonites against the oath, against the covenant of God, Joshua 9:15 through 21 and 2 Samuel 21. And just as they had been slaughtered before, Genesis 34, and again, another covenant, circumcision, the Abrahamic covenant is broken in Genesis 34, just as the Joshua covenant of Joshua 9 is broken in 2 Samuel 21. Twice now, the Gibeonites have been promised what? Protection, which is what? Safety, which is peace, which is what? Salvation. Twice they have been promised this. How's it gone for them? Twice they've been promised, and twice they have been massacred. And who are they? They have been promised salvation and safety, and they have been promised it from those who are the closest to God at the time it was promised. The nation of Israel, his chosen, the possessors of the truth of God, and that twice they have been promised, and twice that has not come. And by the way, it's very important to know, when did the nation of Israel get its name? Yeah. And in Genesis 35. When what? When Genesis 34 was over. Which is where? where they slaughtered the Gibeonites again. Okay, we'll get to that if I can read it. We got 6 or 7 more minutes. Okay, what is interesting is that the Gibeonites are, at the time that Saul attacks them, they are almost in the same position that Israel is in. Israel is the closest to God. They have been chosen by God when they absolutely have no deservedness to Him at all. They have been gracefully given this position. They are the possessors of the truth of God. They have been drug out and anointed and declared the firstborn. Now look at the Gibeonites at the time that Saul attacks them. How close to God are they? They're very close to God. What are they doing? They're temple workers. Was there a temple? No, we don't have a temple till Solomon. So what are they working at? They're in the tabernacle. Who's in the tabernacle? God's in there. I mean, they can see Him because the light comes through the tent. They're very close. Why are they very close? Israel made them that way. You'll be servants. You'll be water carriers and wood chuckers. Yes, and they're in the tabernacle. They're the closest people, probably of all of Israel, besides the priesthood, to God Himself. How do they get there? Is being a water carrier punishment to them? No, it's not. They're very close to God. How much do they know about God now? They're watching this every day. How did they get here? They did, sort of. Now we're back to Genesis 34. We got to go read that. And now they've been wiped out twice. They know all kinds of it. Who do you think knows the sacrificial system better than these Gentile Gibeonites? They know it really well. They know all about it. And they get wiped out twice. Actually, the second time by Saul, which is when they have their full knowledge. And what should they have done? Look. Twice, we have the old saying, first time, shame on you, second time, shame on me, right? You have killed me twice. Should I stay in my job? I should quit. You've broken the covenant. Israel's broken the covenant. Why not quit? Why not leave? Just pick up their stuff and leave. Their covenant had been broken by the people of Israel. Why not rebel? Why not quit? Who would blame them? They don't quit. 2 Samuel 21:3. David asked them, "What can I do so that you will bless the inheritance of God?" What would you expect them to ask for? How many of them have died now? Many, many, many. Let's say 10,000, 20,000, especially from Saul, but going all the way back, probably be a pretty good estimate. Don't know for sure. I've wiped out 50 of your family. What do you want? 50 of my family. They don't want that. With eye for an eye. Eye for an eye means if I kill you, you kill me. If I take off your finger, you take off my finger. It doesn't mean vengeance. It means fairness. You don't get to kill me if I took your eye. I can only get your eye back. You kill my ox, I kill your ox. I don't get to kill your children because you killed my ox. It's fairness. It's not vengeance. What would be fair? I've killed thousands of them. Israel's killed thousands of them. What should we do? What would be fair? We should kill thousands of Israel. How many did they kill? They killed 7. That's extraordinary. Why? Only 7. They asked for only 7. See, the Gibeonites could not be deceived. That's very important. They knew God's character. How did they know it? They worked in the temple. What else did they know? How did they know God's character? They're alive working in the temple. They got the best deal around. How did they get it? This is the Israel doesn't even know this is the best deal. The Gibeonites know this is the best deal. What's it like to be in the presence of God? Just think about it a second. I'm in the presence of God, and I've got a headache. I mean, I get to walk almost literally right up to the Holy of Holies, where the light is. How much fear do I have? I'm almost face to face with Him. Now, I can't be. I'm a Gentile. I don't go in. I'm not the chief priest, the high priest. But it's an extraordinary experience. We can't even imagine what it's like. And they've got it. Did they deserve it? How'd they get it? That's right. They got it because God did it. They didn't. They got it because He promised it. They knew about the character of God. Why didn't they want to kill Jews? Could have. Would David have brought up 20,000, slaughtered them all? Tell me whatever you want. Give us seven. The Gibeonites did not seek the equal slaughter of the Jews. They chose to hang only seven. See, God had remembered them. When did they first come in contact with God? When they were circumcised and massacred. Almost exterminated. And God remembered them. And then they grew into a powerful, mighty city, the greatest city. And they went and they said, no, we know that God has remembered us and preserved us. Now they are in this incredible position. The Gibeonites loved the Jews. There's your evidence. They sought to save the Jews. They didn't want the Jews killed. They didn't want to leave. They wanted to stay what they're doing in the midst of a people that had slaughtered them twice. They knew what God had purposed for Israel. And just as the Gibeonites had been remembered, the circumcision honored, so also would it be honored for Israel. Israel would be likewise remembered. The Gibeonites would know this. Hamor got himself circumcised and killed. What's the obvious question? What, did he have a pure heart? No. He was trying to steal stuff. He was trying to take advantage of Dinah. Be circumcised and killed. What do I ask? Did God honor the circumcision? Do you have a pure heart? Raise your hand if you have a pure heart. Good. Salvation by grace. Killing Jews, however justified, would not occur to the Gibeonites, I don't believe. They would hang seven. And who would they choose? Okay. We're going to make progress. We're going to read Genesis 34, and then next week we'll deal with it. So almost done. The Dinah incident. It's really Genesis 35 we want to read, but we'll do 34 and go in order. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, Gibeonite, prince of her country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. His soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman whom he raped. I have that. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, get me this young woman as a wife. And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with the livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. Not going to fight till I got some support. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him, and the sons of Jacob came in from the field. When they heard it, the men were grieved and very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with him, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife and make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us. Take our daughters to yourselves. By the way, our daughters are a little on the ugly side. I added that. So you shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade in it and acquire possessions for yourself. In other words, we'll buy you off. Then Shechem said to her father and her brothers, let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Does that seem familiar? That's what David said to him. Ask me ever so much dowry and gift, I will give according to what you say to me, but give me the young woman as a wife. But the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, and spoke deceitfully. They're lying. Because he had defiled Dinah, their sister, and they said to him, we cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach to us. But on this condition, we will consent to you. If you will become as we are, if every male of you is circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. And if you will not heed us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and be gone. And their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. So the young man did not delay to do the thing. What is the thing? Circumcision. What is circumcision? It's a sign of the covenant of Abraham, which is what? Salvation. That's right. It is Christ crucified. We'll go back to Moses and Zipporah to get there. Okay? So the young man did not delay to do the thing because he was delighted in Jacob's daughter. He was more honorable than all the household of his father. How's Shechem doing? Who wrote this? Who told him to write it? What did God just call Shechem? Honorable. He just raped the girl. He delighted to be circumcised. He did not delay. He rushed to be circumcised. Did he know what it meant? If somebody comes up to you and says, hey, I want you to be circumcised today. Are you going to ask any questions? What is it? What's it mean? Yeah, is it covered by Blue Cross? And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came to the gate of their city and spoke with the men of their city, saying, these men are at peace with us. Why did they think so? Because of circumcision. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade in it, for indeed the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us as wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men consent to dwell with us, to be one people. If every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised, will not their livestock, their property, and every animal of theirs be ours? What's Hamor doing? He's after their stuff. As opposed to Shechem. And all who went out of the gate of his city heeded Hamor. What's that tell you? There may be some that didn't. Some that didn't go out of the gate of the city. Heeded Hamor and Shechem his son. Every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. Now it came to pass on the third day when they were in pain, and two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city, killed all the males, and they killed Hamor and Shechem, his son, with the edge of the sword and took Dinah. And they plundered them. They took all their stuff. They took their wives. They took their children. And Jacob said to Simeon, verse 30, you have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land. By using the symbol, the sign of the Abrahamic covenant, you used it as a means of murdering people. I shall be destroyed, my household and I. That would be you. But they said, should he treat our sister like a harlot? I want to go quickly to verse 9 of chapter 35. Then God appeared to Jacob again when he came upon Padan Aram, and blessed him. And God said to him, your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name. So he called his name Israel. And so we have a repeating of that. After the slaughter that is in Shechem, we have this emphasis on the name change. My point in all of this is Hamor and his descendants, the ones that lived, they become, or they are, the Gibeonites. Thank you for coming up. They got remembered. And they knew it. They knew that Israel was not deserving of the closeness to God, and they knew that they were not deserving of the closeness to God. They knew that if they were remembered and close to God, then God would remember and be close to Israel. One of the great lies of theology is that God will not remember Israel. Gibeonites do otherwise, and they hanged only seven. Next week, we'll clean all of that up as best we can. Let's rise and be dismissed. Heavenly Father, it is a wonderful truth that you remember, that you come. That help us understand what the Gibeonites clearly understood, that it is an undeserved miracle that we are given access to you, and that it is great honor and brings great joy, and it is something to cling to. Help us be undeceived by the obvious lies that keep coming and keep coming. Please be with us. Thank you for the food that you brought today and gave us. All things come from you. Please bless it. Watch over these people. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.